The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today we're joined by Jeremy R. Hammond. He is a journalist with Foreign Policy Journal. He's written about the questions surrounding the fall of the towers on September 11th, along with many other topics. It's an honor to have him on the show today. Sir, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you.
Now, please begin by telling our audience a little bit more about yourself and some of the important subjects that you have covered in your career.
Sure. Well, I kind of got started during journalism. Essentially, it began after 9/11 when I was not satisfied by the government's answer that the reason that happened was that they hate our freedoms. And so I just began, you know, inquiring about the events and what had gone down on 9/11. And that led to me, of course, they used 9/11 as a pretext for Iraq War. Led me to investigate that as well. And by late 2002, I was, you know, emailing friends and family, telling them that the government was lying, that there's no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. In early 2003, that led to me launching my first website and starting to write articles to get published in alternative publications. Eventually, you know, I kept writing on foreign policy that the questions revolving around 9/11, of course, relate heavily to foreign policy, and really began extensively studying the Israel-Palestine conflict. 2008, launched my website, Foreign Policy Journal, began to really focus on the Israel-Palestine conflict a lot for many years, and then I shifted somewhat. Also began writing about economic issues, you know, financial interests, and especially the role of the Federal Reserve in our society and the economic system. And then in 2012, when our son was born, I really began extensively researching the vaccines. And of course, since COVID-19 pandemic began earlier this year, I've been really focused on that issue and in especially focused on the lockdowns and fighting the authoritarianism that we're seeing with these lockdown regimes. I'm actually currently not publishing Foreign Policy Journal. I had to make the difficult decision to stop doing that earlier this year because it was a totally one man project and I just couldn't sustain it anymore. However, I do publish all my writing still at jeremyrhammond.com, so I would direct people there. And I would like to relaunch Foreign Policy Journal at some point. It's just I need to be able to figure out how to make it sustainable. So I've been publishing all my articles since I made that decision at jeremyrhammond.com. So.
Well, there you go. And there's a lot of great journalists out there who need to have their voices passed around to different people. Again, we are in dangerous times here for free speech, especially on the internet. We've gotten so used to having a free internet for so long. Now the hammer's starting to come down and we're feeling the effects here, and it's affecting the rest of our world. Now, where were you on 9/11? What made you decide that the questions surrounding the destruction of the towers was worth exploring in the first place?
The day of 9/11, I remember I was doing my summer job painting at the time, and I remember I was on a roof and I didn't know about it. My boss at the time had pulled up and let us know what was going on. We turned on the radio and started listening. That's where I was actually when I found out about the events. And then it was about 2 weeks prior to that, I had purchased plane ticket to travel to Taiwan. And been to Taiwan. I arrived on Halloween actually that year, so shortly after the events. And that's really when I did kind of discovered the internet and really began, you know, researching things online and just discovering all the lies that we had been told and discovering that the story that we had been told just didn't add up. And so I began researching foreign policy issues and, you know, reading books by authors like William Bloom and Noam Chomsky and you know, people who are critical of foreign policy In terms of research into, you know, the towers and the World Trade Center 7 in particular, I focused my efforts on. I don't recall exactly when I really had delved into that, but it was most of the work that I kind of did on that was during the time that NIST was doing its investigation and it put out its draft, you know, the two reports that it put out. And I followed that very closely and just scoured those reports. And you know, what struck me about the NIST reports, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which, of course, was responsible for the official investigation of the collapse of World Trade Center 7, was just how blatant the scientific fraud was. I mean, their hypothesis is falsifiable just by their own internal contradictions. For an example of that is, you know, that their hypothesis depended that they put input into their model that there were raging fires on the 12th floor at the time of the collapse in the northeast corner of the building, while their own photographic and videographic analysis of the fires showed that the fires in that area of the building had long since burnt out and moved to the west end of the floor. So that falsifies their hypothesis right there. And there's an additional kind of internal contradictions, self-contradictions in the report that, you know, it's falsifiable on its own grounds, you know, much less, you know, doing requiring to look at, you know, things that they didn't consider or contradictions from outside the report itself. To me, it's a clear example of nothing less than scientific fraud, and I think the fraud is it's so glaring that it's remarkable to me that the profession of engineering and you know, the professional architects and engineer, with exceptions of course like those at the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, who are, you know, honest and courageous enough to speak out and say something, but you know, just in general, the fact that professionals were buying into this and not saying anything about it is really remarkable to me, because even as a layman, I can read that report and see its internal contradictions and see that, you know, that there's serious problems with the claims it's making. And of course, you know, the biggest one of all being the free fall collapse of the building that it initially denied in its draft report and then acknowledged in its final report. But, you know, notably they removed statement in the draft report that had said that the collapse time of the building, not the acceleration, but the collapse time of the building was consistent with physical principles. But of course, they had denied free fall in the draft report, and they say that they didn't look at the instantaneous acceleration of the building. They just calculated the overall collapse time, saying it was consistent with physical principles. In the final report, where they acknowledged that free fall, yes, indeed, it did indeed occur, they removed that statement. They removed the statement saying that it was consistent with physical principles, because of course, it's not. You know, this is simple laws of physics. The building, you know, free fall collapse means that all of the building's potential energy was converted to kinetic energy, which means that there was no energy available to do the work of buckling columns as required by NIST's fire-induced collapse hypothesis. And so, you know, it's just falsifiable on all these different grounds. And there's just details in there in terms of you look at their complicated hypothesis, which basically, to summarize, if I can, it's, you know, they claim that thermal expansion of beams in the 12th floor ceiling, you know, pushed a girder off its seat on the 79th column, resulting in a loss of lateral support of that column. So the column buckled, and which, you know, triggered this progressive collapse, resulting in, you know, this pre-fall collapse of the building. You know, there's things like they claim that there were no shear studs on the floor, but they were. they were in the diagrams and the drawings of the building. They claim that you know, that the girder was pushed off its seat on the 79th column, but their own simulation showed that didn't happen because it butted up against the flange of the column and then the 79th floor. I mean, there's so many contradictions in the report that it's just astonishing to me that anyone, any professionals bought that and just accepted that as, you know, a scientific report that conclusively determined that the fire, you know, that the building collapsed due to fire. So that's really when I, you know, around that time of the reports was when I was really deeply investigating that and researching, particularly the World Trade Center 7 building. And I didn't focus so much on the other towers because to me, it's kind of like, well, if you can show really conclusively that the official hypothesis for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is false, which of course leaves the only alternative hypothesis remaining is the controlled demolition hypothesis, which better fits the evidence. Then it's really not necessary to show that the other two towers were also demolished and didn't collapse due to fire. I mean, it's much easier, I think, to persuade people with World Trade Center 7, in other words, than with the other towers. It's just so much easier to show, to demonstrate that the official version is false. And so I just focus my efforts on that. You know, just thinking in terms of, you know, if I'm going to reach people who are, you know, not questioning this or you know, maybe have questions about it, but, you know, lean toward accepting the official narrative, World Trade Center 7 is kind of a smoking gun. So that's why I focus my efforts on that building.
A big problem is the U.S. mainstream media. And unfortunately, even though a lot of them are considered as jokes by a big part of this country, people still turn to them in times of crisis. The first thing that they do when something happens of major significance in this country is they turn on the television. And while they're getting the live images that a lot of the alternative media cannot provide, they're getting also a lot of that commentary and a lot of the narrative shaped by them. Now, in your bio on Foreign Policy Journal, you wrote, "The mainstream media dutifully serves to manufacture consent for criminal policies." Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, borrowing the term manufacturing consent there from Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky, who wrote the book Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, in which they describe, you know, in scholarly detail how, you know, it's obvious that, you know, in totalitarian regimes that actually, you know, own the media, why propaganda exists, and it's very obvious. But, you know, when you think about a democratic society, supposedly with a supposed free press, you know, how can it be that the press serves to, you know, issue propaganda, state propaganda? And so they go about explaining precisely why that is the case, with numerous case studies. And I just take that same theme essentially in most of the work that I do. A lot of my articles follow the same format. I just go through and I say, well, this is what the mainstream media is reporting, and then these are, you know, for example, this is what their sources say that contradict what the media is saying. A lot of times you can falsify their claims just by looking at their own sources and things. So I say, this is what the mainstream narrative is. These are the facts, and these are the conclusions we can draw. And it's quite easy to do. It's just, it's a never-ending job to debunk these mainstream narratives, people are just being blatantly lied to, and it's just this political propaganda that's intended to, again, to use that, borrow that term, to manufacture consent for whatever policies, you know. And again, going back to my origin in terms of when I got started doing journalism, the Iraq War was a really good clear example that is a really important lessons for us. From history and important lessons, I think, for future generations, in how the media served that function. And, just repeating lies, repeating claims from government officials as though proven fact, when, of course, there was not only no evidence to support those claims, but the evidence contradicted those claims. You know, for example, looking at reports from the UN inspectors going back that, you know, a long time, going back throughout the 90s. Showing that Iraq had been disarmed, and of course the CDC later admitted that yes, Iraq was disarmed in 1991, and in 2003 no longer had stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, no longer had programs to develop weapons of mass destruction. And so that war happened because the American people, many people did rise up, but not in sufficient numbers, and there wasn't enough protest to change the political equation for the politicians. And so it was just too much consent. Too many people were either apathetic and didn't care, or actually, outright supported the war, vocally supported the war. And so that was a good example of how the media manufactured consent for an illegal war of aggression. And so it's the same with foreign policy. It's, you know, whether we're talking about wars like the Iraq war, the intervention in Syria, Israel-Palestine conflict. It's the same with domestic issues, like you have that public vaccine policy where government and media are issue propaganda to manufacture consent for CDC recommendations. It's the same thing with the lockdowns today and the policies that are in place. And we're supposed to believe that these are, you know, it's, oh, you know, there's like this scientific consensus in favor of lockdowns or something. It's completely ludicrous nonsense. You know, going back, you look at WHO's, for example, pandemic response preparedness plans predating COVID-19, and a lot of the things that they did in response to COVID-19 were things that they said, you know, these things don't work, they shouldn't be done. And so the country that followed the playbook was actually Sweden, but of course the mainstream media talked about Sweden's response, the non-lockdown response in Sweden, as though, you know, Sweden was performing this experimenting on its population, but it actually was every other country. Sweden was following the playbook, and every other country that was experimenting on its population with these extreme lockdown measures that, of course, caused massive economic harm, massive social disruption, and with consequences that are measured not just in terms of dollars, but of course in terms of health and lives. And just to give one example, the UN has estimated, you know, that well over 100,000 excess deaths from excess infant mortality in developing countries, hundreds of thousands of excess cases of wasting, extreme childhood malnutrition as a result of the economic disruptions and supply chain disruptions and things that result from these global lockdown policies and things like this. But of course, the mainstream media isn't reporting all the harms of these measures, that, with some exceptions. I mean, but they're typically, New York Times is a great example of how it's just reporting in ways that cause mass fear and manufactured consent for these extreme political responses. And so, really, no matter what the issue is, whatever, if there's an important issue and the media are covering it, I mean, there's manufacture of consent happening, and there's propaganda related to that topic, and I can't think of a topic where this isn't the case.
Right, and it's something that the mainstream media feeds that I think is also hindering our abilities to get on top of these issues and get policy on things like what you were describing back into a reasonable realm of thought and practice is the polarization of politics. And I'm not even going to use real examples because I don't want people to get lost in that. So instead of saying left or right, I'm just going to say Team A and Team B. So let's say you're on Team A and I'm on Team B, but we both agree on a particular thing, but this particular issue has been put into Team A's category. Oh, if you agree with this, then you must be from Team A. So now that puts me on the defensive because maybe I don't like the figurehead of Team A or what this person has said or done in the past. But because I happen to agree with you on this particular thing, I must be Team A, but I don't want to be identified with Team A. So I'm going to shy away from that. And the same thing can happen in reverse. So people get pigeonholed into these groups, and nobody can ever agree on what they are united on. I think instead of left and right in this country, it should be looked at as what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. And I really think that is the new paradigm. All those other differences can be put aside until we get things back into regular working order here. But that is another way that they control us.
Yeah, I just totally want to agree. And I would even add to that, I mean, just as an example for myself, I mean, when I write about foreign policy issues and criticize, government intervention overseas and in these illegal wars, people assume that they criticize me as being an extreme leftist. But then when I write something like policies against the lockdown measures, they assume that I'm extreme rightist. And it's like people are just, they have this inability to think beyond like this linear spectrum of like left and right, liberal and conservative, Democrat and Republican. And it's like just the inability to think beyond that such narrow framework and that narrow paradigm is really disturbing, that people can't even like get past that in like the ways that you're talking. And like, look, it's not about left or right. It's like what's reasonable, what's not reasonable, or the ways that, if there's certain policies are happening under a Democratic administration and people on the left are fine with it. And then if those same policies happen under a Republican administration, of course they're criticizing it and vice versa. And so, you have this just back and forth with these political parties in power. And a lot of times these policies never change and they're really consistent. And, you know, whether they're criticized or not depends on whether the criticizer is, you know, on the left or right or not. And it's just so inconsistent and hypocritical. And I fully agree with what you're saying there about the need to just, like, it's not about that. It's about what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. I think that's the perfect approach. And people need to be able to rise above and get, you know, think beyond that narrow framework and that narrow perspective.
Right. And I've always said for years I wanted people to be more politically awake. But as I've seen what's developed, I don't mean in this way the shallow kind of just pick a team and root for it no matter what, like we see on the Super Bowl. It sort of reminds me of the religious wars of many hundreds of years ago where people are just focused on one team and not on what is right or wrong. And hopefully it doesn't get as extreme as we've seen in those earlier examples from centuries ago. But I mean, I see the same kind of mentality, same kind of zealots taking form. So hopefully that gets under control. Now, as a journalist, especially on the internet, and I did this too before I worked at AE, I used to write articles, I used to submit them to various places, and of course I had another job, and I guess kind of how I sustained myself. There's a lot of people doing that kind of stuff right now, some people more professional than others, but considering what we've seen with censorship on various platforms, what do you think the future of alternative news is? Where is it headed for people like us?
That's a great question. You know, I see an opportunity today to really, you know, for independent journalists, citizen journalists, to really just overturn the entire business model of the mainstream corporate media. And I think that mainstream corporate media see this. I mean, for many years now, they've been struggling. I mean, with the advent of the internet and people being able to go online and read news for free, and you know, the mainstream corporate news organizations really have been struggling with this. And in some ways, they've kind of overcome and found ways to actually maintain profitability. And you know, with whether it's subscription models or whatever it might be, you know. Different sources of advertising and whatnot, but you know they're still struggling. They're still trying to figure out how to make this work with just information available at people's fingertips online. And so the alternative media are a real threat to the corporate media. And I think that is a fundamental conflict of interest when the media take on this role of, you know, fact checking, quote unquote. You know, have these self-proclaimed fact checkers that are, you know, supposedly out there, you know, guiding us and preventing us from seeing this dangerous misinformation. And yet, you know, many of my articles I've written now focus on some of these fact check articles, showing how they're censoring information that is accurately, truthfully reported, while themselves hypocritically spreading misinformation, like demonstrably false claims that they're making. And you can demonstrate, you can show that what they're saying is untrue. And yet these are the supposed fact checkers. And then of course, Facebook partners with some of these groups that, you know, doing these fact checking, supposed fact checking and is censoring information, you know, from its users in this way. And so there's this kind of conflict of interest with the corporate media taking on this role of, you know, kind of determining what's true and what's not, you know, kind of being the arbiter of truth, because I mean, it's in their business interests to say everyone should get their information from us. Don't go to those alternative news sources where you can read information for free. You know, you need a subscription to us to get the truth, because all these other, you know, alternative information sources are spreading all this misinformation. So I think it's kind of, you know, that's kind of part of what's going on. There's this kind of, you know, this kind of conflict of interest that's happening. And it's really obvious when the media, you know, take on this role of, you know, I mean, for example, Foreign Policy, my publication, Foreign Policy Journal, was listed among 200 websites that was reported by the World, the Washington Post, that, you know, of being a Russia propaganda website, you know, making claims about, when at the time that after Trump was elected and the claim was made that, you know, he'd stole the election and in collaboration with the government of Russia, which of course was a story that was put out in response to the emails that were, you know, released by Wikipedia not Wikipedia, I'm sorry, WikiLeaks, showing, you know, the what had happened in the Democratic establishment and how they were trying to align Bernie Sanders and make sure that Hillary Clinton was the nominee for the, you know, was going to be the Democratic nominee for the presidency. And so they put out this this kind of counterclaim about Trump, you know, being involved. And there's all kinds of conspiracy theories about that, you know, like that the Russians had hacked the election system. And I've written a couple of articles on that showing how there was no evidence for that whatsoever. And just dissecting those kind of conspiracy they're the ones putting out these conspiracy theories. But of course, you know, they always use that term conspiracy theory to malign anything that doesn't, you know, doesn't fall within the mainstream narrative is, you know, they dismiss as a conspiracy theory. But conspiracy theories are fine, you know, like with the Iraq war, you know, with 9/11, but, you know, they're promoting conspiracy theories all the time. And yet they have this kind of hypocritical use of the phrase. And so, you know, getting back to the question, I really see a big opportunity for independent citizen journalists to really be a force for good and just challenging the whole business model of the mainstream media. But, you know, we're not there yet. I think there's a lot. I think, you know, number one, the quality of work needs to be improved in terms of independent journalists and what's out there. And, you know, I think there needs to be more kind of collaborative efforts. And we have a long way to go, but I think we're moving in the right direction. And there's a lot of great work being done by people who are totally independent. And like you said, you know, maybe they have a job and they're just doing this on this. That's how I started. I mean, now I'm doing it full time. But, and, you know, for a long time, I was teaching English in Taiwan while I was doing all this research and writing about things. And I just came to the point where it's like, this is just too much. I need to be doing this full time. And I try to figure out a way to manage to be able to actually earn a living while continuing to do this work. So I don't do it to make money, but I need to be able to make money to continue doing it. And so, you know, right currently my work is funded primarily through donations from readers. And people just like what I do and they support me. So they're keeping me going.
Yeah. And I'm going to encourage people to do that and to check out Mr. Hammond's work here. Very fine stuff going on. And this is the stuff that we need to see more people doing. Again, it's just a few hours a night. If you have a story to tell, or you have some kind of analysis of a situation to give at least once a week or once a month, start a blog, get that whole trend going again. It's like being a superhero. You get your daytime job, then you get your night job, saving the world. That's the way you need to look at it. So, Mr. Hammond, thank you so much for all the work that you're doing, and thank you for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Say have a great week. Good luck.